What has surprised you about evil? So if you walk with Jesus for any length of time, you know, you learn about God, you learn a lot about goodness, the different aspects of goodness, and quite necessarily, you also learn a lot about evil. You have occasion to reflect on it and how it works. So I'm asking kind of you veteran Jesus followers, what has surprised you about evil? The masks. The masks that evil wears. The evil, evil is a pretender, disguises itself. That's really good. Kent? How just and holy evil can look, which goes to mask. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Who's that in the back? I can't see. Oh, Charlene. You're still surprised that it exists. You still get surprised. Well, that's interesting. One of the things that's surprising about evil is that it can still surprise you. It's like I figure I'd be used to it by now, but actually, it's just like interesting. Beth, it's creative. It's creative. That's interesting. Evil is creative. Yeah. Yeah. That's a provocative question. Is it creative or is it creatively destructive? Yeah, Mike. It's very banal. It's you know, banal means like boring, ordinary. Let me go to C.S. Lewis. One of my favorite quotes on evil. All evil is petty. That you think of great evil being lordly and, you know, almost majestic and powerful. Actually, it's just the snotty-nosed bully in middle school. That's all it ever is. Yeah. Was it David? How do
I?
Subtle and camouflaged. It's not necessarily intimidating. It can be kind of easygoing. Yes, Rania.
I think that evil is the loser that never gives up. It's
evil never gives up. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it doesn't get tired. Yeah, it's always around. It's like gum on your shoe. Yeah, it's going back, Nina. We humans are no dummies at self-rationalizing. It's like, you can excuse it easily, right? And that's kind of surprising. Yeah, Karen.
I found it manipulating me.
It manipulates you. It pulls your strings. It's a con man, evil. That's it. John. The most well-intended pure Christians can have some of it. It lurks everywhere. Like, it touches everything. Yes. Robin?
I'm surprised
that it's still allowed, right? Because I mean, this is like, you know, a big one. Like, if there is a righteous God, wouldn't he just eradicate it? And if he doesn't eradicate it, like, what's the deal? You know, is it evil? And so its existence is a conundrum that in its existence in and of itself is troubling and fatiguing. Last one, in the back. There are different rankings and level of power to it. So it can feel different at different times. It can strike you differently at different times. All very interesting. As I suspected, you guys know a disturbing amount about evil. Yeah. Do you remember how you encountered it at the beginning? Like when you were young, and what made you first thinking about evil? I actually don't. I as I shared in this sermon series, I remember the moment I first realized that people die. I don't remember the moment when I realized what evil was like or that there was evil in the world. I think, you know, we have some idea of good and bad that we form like really, really early in life. Maybe it comes from comfort and discomfort. But I do remember kind of having this instinctive sense about it and reflecting on the passage that we're going to go through this week. I was recalling a story from my own life. I was seven. I think I was about to turn eight, or maybe I had just turned eight, and I was living alone with my grandmother at the time. We were living outside of Sacramento, California, this kind of rundown neighborhood. And I was out wandering the neighborhood one day, and I wandered into this empty field. and really tall grass. I remember it being really tall, but of course I was short, so you know, it probably wasn't that tall, but it was kind of up to my face. And I stumbled in the middle of this abandoned lot, this empty field. Somebody had built this clubhouse, sort of like scrap lumber and cardboard was there. You know, so I just kind of discovered this in my new neighborhood, and had a little door. So I scratched down and I walked into the clubhouse just to see what was there. And it was wallpapered with Playboy centerfolds. And it was the first time I had ever encountered something like that. You know, back in those days, pornography was Playboy. It's like that was all we had, you know. And I was just like, ugh, I'd never seen it, but I immediately knew what it was. I remember this instinctive anger came out of me, this little seven-year-old kid. It just really made me angry. And I probably could not have articulated why, but it was automatic. It was instinctive. It was just from the spirit. And I just started tearing it down with my little fists. I just started tearing down this centerfold, and I bundled them all up, and I remember I kicked dirt on them, and then I went outside, and I tore down the clubhouse, you know, and I stomped it, and I didn't know who it belonged to, and then I just left, never told anybody about it. Man, those were the days, right? Those were the days when my reaction to evil was just like simple and pure and just right on and automatic. You know, I was a little less sullied than I am now. Now, you know, if I had an experience like, I'd probably just crack a snarky joke and think nothing of it. You know, my tolerance has improved or gotten worse. I was Hugh Hefner, the guy that started Playboy, the pioneer. He died a few years back, and I remember reading through his eulogies, and I remember reading like one in the Atlantic. They were posted online, and he was lionized as sort of a pioneer of sexual freedom. And I can remember in the 70s and early 80s when he was still vilified as an exploiter of women. And somehow in our lifetime, in our generation, if you're about my age, that industry has gone from exploitive and shallow to empowering of women. This line from an Atlantic article said that that what he did was a, how do you say it? His movement considered feminism a sister movement because it empowered women and freed men from shame and guilt. And that's kind of where he sits in current morality. And all that's happened in my lifetime. Is it exploitation or is it empowerment? Is it the cheapening of women, or is it my body, my power? And that's just happened in our lifetime, the way we think about that particular form of evil. And I'm thinking about this today because we're in the sermon series on Revelation, and we're introduced to a new character in the book of Revelation. We're going to be in Revelation 17 today, and it's a character called depending on your translation, the Harlot of Babylon. It's this figure that this larger-than-life sort of figure of what in that day would have been considered a temple prostitute. Religions all over the world have temple prostitutes. Sometimes they're women, sometimes they're men. Well, rarely men, but often boys. It was true of primitive religions all around the world. So the idea of this this very attractive woman who's also murderous and kind of shameful, looks kind of clean and seductive on the one hand, but is really massively destructive on the other hand. And it's about, you know, two faces of evil, masks, or evil that looks holy, looks like freedom, but is actually death, that sort of thing. And Revelation has quite a bit of meditation upon that. As I explain in the series, Revelation is mostly about the great reality that is behind the curtain, that everything that we see in this world is not everything that there is. We're facing a great coming reality called death, and death is a passageway into something that is a bit more real for everyone. So that's the initial meditation. The world is presented as something that we have to overcome. There's a picture of salvation in the book of Revelation, but it's not the sort of salvation like accept Jesus and be forgiven. It's the sort of that sort of salvation that comes from overcoming all of the evil against you. You have to be an overcomer if you want to make it. And then in the bulk of Revelation, kind of the middle part, has four visions of the same thing. It's the same idea presented in four successive visions and slightly different symbolism. And every vision is basically the suffering that is in the world is in some part sent by God himself. And the reason God sends suffering into the world is to motivate us to be fighters and overcomers, to provoke faithfulness in the face of pain. So it's about overcoming. And those visions get sort of progressively grander. This shows the intensity of the opposition that comes. Last week, we looked at vision number three, which taught us that the evil that comes against us in the world is not just like a personified evil, just like, you know, the devil. The evil that comes against us in the world is actually systemic. It's the whole world system. We need to overcome the entire world. You can't trust any facet of it. It feels very totalitarian. That's not a word that existed back in the day, but if it did, it might have been in the book of Revelation. Evil is a totalitarian dictator. It wants to control every facet of life. It's sneaky that way. Well, this week, we get the fourth and final vision of this thing in the book of Revelation, and we get to see the spirit that sits atop this great system of murder. And that's what it is. The world system is described as like Murder, Inc. You know, it is industrial holocaust. And the spirit that sits on top of that, kind of controlling it all, is a bit surprising. That spirit does not look exactly what you would think that it looks like. So let's read from Revelation chapter 17. I'll read 14 verses. Some of the symbols that you see in this passage you have seen elsewhere in the book of Revelation, and so you should be able to interpret them fairly easily. Revelation, if you're just catching up, is written essentially in hieroglyphics. It's written with prophetic symbols that we can understand. We are supposed to be able to understand. So some of these symbols are already familiar. You'll be able to crack them, and then there's this one additional symbol of this woman of ill repute. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, so John is seeing these pictures in heaven. There's some bowls being poured out, and they all have sort of wrath and suffering in them. And we get to the end of that process, and then one of the angels, one of the instructors, comes to John and says, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters." Well, that's new. What the heck is that? "With her kings, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." So John says, the angel says to John, "All right, now you've seen all of these great glories of heaven, you've seen the great suffering of the earth, now I'm going to show you kind of the linchpin spirit." And the linchpin spirit is going to be in the form of this prostitute, with which all the kings of the earth, all the powers of the earth, are committing adultery. And she's sitting on near many waters, which means she's a global enterprise, right? With all the oceans, all the rivers, wherever travel happens, this woman, this symbol, has authority, and all the kings of the earth committed adultery with her. And this is a way of describing the world system. All right, so that's the thesis statement, and then this happens. "Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert or a wilderness. And there I saw a woman," this is her, "sitting on a scarlet beast," a scarlet being the color of ill repute. The beast, we have already read about the beast in the book of Revelations. The beast represents the world system, the evil world system. So this is on top of the beast. So this is like the king of it all and the queen of it all. This woman, sitting on a scarlet beast, was covered with blasphemous names and had 7 heads and 10 horns. Well, we already kind of know what that is, that beast that represents the whole system of the world. It's got its tentacles everywhere. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, very festive colors, party colors, and was glittering with gold. So very fancy, precious stones and pearls. This is a very attractive lady, in other words. This is like Hollywood red carpet sort of adornment. And she held a golden cup in her hand. So very extravagant party. Filled with abominable things and filled and the filth of her adulteries. So everything looks great, but the sustenance is toxic. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. So the juxtaposition is striking. You get this, think of like this really sexy Hollywood starlet at a party, you know, like a magazine cover with, you know, the glitterati coming out for, I don't know, an Oscar party or something. Didn't the Oscars happen recently? And it's like that sort of thing. But then you kind of see a label. Well, this represents Babylon, which is like the canonical evil city of the world and the mother of prostitutes, the mother of abominations. It's like, this is the source of it all. This spirit is the source of all the grossness, is what we're getting here. And I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints. All right. Ooh, that's disgusting. All right. She's tipsy. She's intoxicated. She's been partying. Well, what's gotten her high? Torturing Christians. So this is like, you know, Holocaust level stuff. Makes her happy and joyful. The blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. And when I saw her, I was greatly astonished. And that's interesting. We're going to come back to that in a second. But John has seen incredible things. John has seen the throne room of heaven. John has seen celestial creatures. He saw stars fall from the sky. John has seen the drama of the ages unfolding. He's had global visions, but this vision astonishes him. Something about this flabbergasts him. So we'll get back to that in a second. And then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and go to his destruction." So once was, now isn't, will come again. More on that in a second. "The inhabitants of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world will be astonished when they see the beast." So they won't be astonished by seeing sexy starlet evil demon woman. They'll be astonished when they see the beast, which once was, now isn't, will come. More on that in a second. So they get astonished for a different reason, in other words, the ones who aren't following Jesus. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. They are also 7 kings, 5 have fallen, 1 is, and the other has not yet come. But when he comes, he must remain for a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an 8th king. He belongs to the 7 and is going to his destruction. Is that clear? It is if you're kind of used to reading this stuff. So this calls for a mind with wisdom. In other words, all right, think this through. This is a riddle. You guys should be able to crack it with just a moment's thought. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman sits. In the Bible, cities or regions represent systems. So a city of 7 hills kind of represents this beast of Babylon, this evil global campaign. What's a city that sits on 7 hills? Rome. There you go. I knew there'd be some world travelers. What's another city that sits on 7 hills? Trivia buffs. San Francisco. Yeah. And so what the Bible is saying is that there's a template here of really wicked totalitarian cities sitting on seven hills, right? Like they once were, sometimes they're not, but they're going to come again. In other words, there's this sort of template for evil systems. Think about this. This woman sits on top of it. Like, you guys, what the prophecy is saying is here is like, you guys are persecuted by Rome right now in the first century AD, but it's not Rome. There'll be lots of Romes through the ages. What happens is that cities grow up and they're controlled by this spirit, evil spirit of seduction. So that's what you're actually fighting against. There'll be kings that come. Right now, you might think that, you know, five kings have passed. You have a king. There'll be one in the future. You're telling yourself what has been won't last forever. And that's true. But, you know, then there'll be another system that will be like an eighth king. And he'll have his own progeny. So what the prophecy is saying here is like, this is just kind of how it works in the world, right? These things come, they go, you can count them. But once they're done, they just start over. There's always, you know, a system. There's always a city that dominates the earth with its vileness. You get the idea? That's kind of what it's saying. The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom. This is about the future. But who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. In other words, this will happen again and again through the ages. They have one purpose. All of these people that kind of play into this system, all of these people that are captured by the evil harlot seduction of the age, they have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They buy into the beast and they empower the evil system. What is that purpose? They will make war against the Lamb. The Lamb, of course, being Jesus. But the Lamb will overcome them because he's Lord of Lords and King of Kings. Like, he's the real one. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Just describe this great global evil system, but yeah, in the end, Jesus will overcome them. What really rivets me about that statement in verse 14 there is, or 13 and 14, is that this whole world system, you might think that it's just sort of evolved out of convenience, that, you know, it's just has happened to work out this way. But the prophecy says, no, it's designed to destroy Jesus and his faithful followers. The entire world is bent to that one aim, which is an astonishing claim, How many of you look out at the cities of the world and think, danger, you know, like they're trying to kill me? But that's how Revelation presents it. It's like, do not be anything less than serious when you think about overcoming the systems of the world. A couple words about why John was astonished. John has been shown in successive visions all the evil of the world, right? He's been shown that there's a system designed to stamp out faith on the planet. He has seen great and epic things. And then this is a final vision of the beast, and then he sees this woman sitting on top of it, and she's presented as an attractive prostitute, a seductress. This wouldn't be like a sex trafficking victim. Right, someone who's forced into the trade. This would be someone who's honored for what she does, a courtesan or a temple prostitute, somebody whose job in society is to be seductive and corruptive. So, very disreputable. I think John is astonished when he sees her because of this. If I were to describe to you a totalitarian system designed to murder every Christian on earth, and then I said, I want you to visualize the spirit that sits atop that and runs everything, the image that would pop into your head would probably look a lot like the Grim Reaper, right? You'd look like Freddy Krueger. People still know those movies? No? You're too young? Who's the boogeyman these days? The Joker? Nah. Anyway, the Grim Reaper, right? The guy with the sickle and the dark hood, right? You would think that the spirit atop of Holocaust Inc. would look like murder incarnate, right? But the spirit that sits atop Global Holocaust Inc. doesn't look like murder incarnate. The system that sits atop Global Holocaust Inc. looks like a beautiful Hollywood starlet, decked out perfectly, you know, having a good time, drinking from gold. It's like, this is the person I want to party with. This is the person I want to be like. This is glamour itself. This is that person who's like, looks beautiful, but sits just outside traditional morality, and so feels all the sexier because she's just a little dangerous, you know what I mean? Right? That's the spirit that sits atop of all the evil. You know, that's the mask anyway. It doesn't look like murder. Looks like a good time. Looks a little titillating. And you know, evil has many facets. We see many facets of evil in this book, but the prophecy of John is saying, but this is the key to them all. This is the head honcho. The head honcho evil spirit kind of looks attractive until you look really, really close. And then it's like, oh, she's drunk on the blood of Christians. It's like, oh, pshaw, don't take that seriously. After all, yeah, Christians aren't all that. You know, we don't really need the church anyway. That's the spirit that we're really up against. And then the unfaithful, they get astonished. They're astonished when they see the beast. Notice that in the passage? So they're not astonished when they see the beautiful woman. They're astonished when they see the beast. Why? Because they've been fixated on the beautiful woman. And when the truth is revealed to them, they're like, oh, crud. We were just partying with a honey. We did not realize that it was Holocaust Inc. And so they're like, that's not what it felt like. And then they're tripping on that. You understand the difference? Christians are deceived because they think evil is really ugly, but actually it can be beautiful. And then evil people are deceived because they thought that they were just having a fine time and they didn't realize they were contributing to global Holocaust. Yeah, you feel it? That's the vision. This is kind of mind-blowing. This one disturbs me, you know, it disturbs me. It disturbs me in the same way that I'm disturbed when I think about the arc of my relationship with evil over the years. It's like, yeah, you know, when I was 7 years old and I encountered this little pornography shrine in Sacramento, California, I was just like, no, you know. But now I feel like I could just not even register it. Or worse, be attracted to it, right? It's like, oh, you know, yeah, yeah, I get it. I get it. How far I have fallen. How far I have fallen. I've been convinced. I've been seduced. I've been co-opted. You know, it wasn't one thing that did me in. A thousand things from a thousand different directions, because it's a whole system, right? Everything has convinced me to give into it, you know, entertainment, education, you know, the university system, politics, even the church itself on occasion. It's like, you know what? It's not that bad. It's not that bad. No need to get upset about it. So this is sort of the rationale, you know, for me saying things like I do. I'm fond of saying the world is a lying cult trying to control you. Well, that's a bit extreme and pessimistic, Jordan. Like, well, no, that's just the reality. you know, we live in, and it's burdensome, and it's inconvenient, and it, you know, and it's discouraging. And I understand. It's sobering, but it's sobering in a world that's drunk on blood. The world's not drunk on blood, you know. Well, it doesn't look like it, but in that golden goblet of sexy seductiveness is actually blood. It just doesn't look like it until you look closely. The world is a lying cult trying to control you. It tries to control you in a zillion different ways. It tries to control you systematically. But on top of it all, the driving ideology of evil is to present itself in a not so serious way. It presents itself as a party girl or a party boy. Hey, you know, just relax. You know, you deserve a break. Don't be an extremist. Don't be a fanatic. Don't be a zealot. Come on. That's the driving ideology of evil. And the job of the great prostitute of Babylon, the mother of all prostitution, the mother of all adulteries, is to make evil look good. That's her job. That's its job. Make evil look good. And probably to make righteousness look bad. You know, and it just tickles me that in the face of that, Jesus shows up dressed in rags, looks like a poor beggar. We're told by the Old Testament prophets there was nothing attractive in him that we should desire him. You know, that's how God appears, complete opposite spirit. This came up, I'll end with this passage, this from Genesis 4. It came up in our Hana group Wednesday night, and we were discussing the Revelations package. This is the story of it's the story of early humankind. It's the story of this guy named Lamech, who was one of the great grandsons of Cain, the murderer of Abel. So in Genesis 4, you get these boring genealogies, and I find this one kind of entertaining. So, you know, the story of Cain and Abel. Cain killed his brother, and Cain got a mark of grace, and then he went out and he built a city, a Cain city, you know. The city was named Enoch, but it was sort of a prefigurement of the city of Babylon, a representative of the evil system of the world. And to Enoch, Cain's son, was born Arad, and to Arad was born Mahujael, and Mahujael was the father of Mahushael, and Mahushael was the father of Lamech. So far, so boring. And Lamech, it says this in Genesis 19, and you would think, what? Why is this in there? Lamech married two women. Up until that point, one man, one woman. But Lamech was an innovator. Lamech married two women. And the implication is, he got a little grief for this. It's like, dude, like, can we do that? Like, I thought, like, you know, the bond is like one mate for life sort of thing. And it's like, hey, you know, two is a party. Lamech married two women, one named Ada and the other named Zillah. And Ada gave birth to Jabal. And he was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. And his brother's name was Jubal. And he was the father of all the play of the harp and the fruit. Humans were inventing things. And Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze. There's a lot of information here. Tubal-Cain, in a different language, was translated as Vulcan. And he became the god Vulcan, worshipped as a god who was the forge god. Anyway, and Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. Remember, Cain had a mark of grace. But in ancient Hebrew, there is no distinction between statements and questions grammatically. So this is a mistranslation. The way it should read is, Ada and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, listen to me. Have I killed a man for injuring me? If Cain is avenged 77 times, he actually killed somebody. Cain did. Then if Cain is avenged seven times, then I'll be avenged 77 times. In other words, this is what the dude is saying. So I slept with two women instead of one. It's not like I'm a murderer. And God can forgive murder, so why are you uptight about a little sexual fun? And I see Lamech as like the world's first frat boy, right? He's like, hey, man, it's just a party. So we slept around a little bit. It's not like we actually hurt anybody. And it was like the very first excuse like that. And it's registered in the book of Genesis because this is the beginning of the science of justification. Lamech was the innovator, the father of all of that. At least Cain knew that he did wrong. Lamech was like, ah, it's not like I'm contributing to the Holocaust. I get to Revelation, it's like, no, that's the very spirit of the Holocaust right there. So I'd like to leave you with one thing to think about, and this has been such an uplifting sermon. You know, Satan is a moralist. Evil feels different ways. Evil can feel really petty. It can feel like anger. To me, it often comes out of grumpiness. You know, it can feel ordinary. Evil can feel many different ways, but great evil, epic evil, always feels like justification. Great evil always feels like justification. It always comes with a spirit of justification. Just having a little party. And so, if you're a spiritual traveler and you find yourself, you know, justifying, it's not like I killed someone. They gotcha. They gotcha. Or when you're looking at great evil in the world and you hear people trying to rationalize it, it's like, it's actually the rationalization that kills hordes of people. Because if you could see it as it was, you'd be flabbergasted and astonished. The ugliness would amaze you. But the rationalizations and the justification, see, that's what keeps you from seeing the truth about things. And so great evil always feels like justification. It's gussying up blood. It's gilding a cup of blood. It's putting jewels and glory on an adulteress or an adulterer. That's the spirit of it. That's the essential spirit that we're up against. That is the focal point of the battle of the ages. So what you want to do is get on Jesus' side of that battle. And the opposite of justification is, well, it's honesty, it's repentance, it's humility, right? That's why we do that. It's because if you're someone who's cultivated a spirit of kind of confession and repentance, then you are fighting against the spirit of justification, and the enemy can't touch you anymore, right? It's not that you're perfect, it's that you're just not playing at justification. And that is the very heart of Christianity. That is the very heart of it, right? That's grace. The opposite of great evil in this world is not great goodness so much as it is honest grace. Just being honest about what the situation is. Yeah. So, Father, I pray for nothing more this morning than a spirit of honesty. I mean, goodness gracious, none of us are perfect, Lord. And like me, a lot of us have fallen. We are not indignant against evil as we ought to be. We're not even as good as we were, maybe, when we were kids. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But at least, Lord, at least deliver us from false justifications and rationalizations. At least that, Lord, so that we can end on the right side of this cosmic battle. So when the curtain falls, we're not finding ourselves arrayed against Jesus, but rather lined up with him.